Good morning. We're on sheet three. And today, as I said to you before, what I want to do is I want to try and connect the dots a little bit. I want to bring Torah Shebi'ah Ktav and Torah Shebi'ah Peh together and try and understand the relationship between them. I want to start with this beautiful piece from Rav Hirsch. This is a very famous quote from Rav Hirsch, where Rav Hirsch does something quite unusual. Don't forget that Rav Hirsch was writing to a non-religious audience. He was writing in Germany 150, 160 years ago to a group of people who were secular, who were often from reformed communities, but who were interested. So he's writing to a very modern crowd in many ways, and he's trying to explain what Torah Shebi'ah Peh is for. So he says the Torah Shebi'ah Ktav, number one, is to the Torah Shebi'ah Peh in the relation of short notes on a full and extensive lecture of any scientific subject. In other words, the relationship between Torah Shebi'ah Peh and Torah Shebi'ah Ktav is like the relationships between my lecture and your lecture notes. When you take lecture notes down, they're meaningful to you. You make squiggles, you draw a smiley face, you put a comment, an exclamation mark. When you reread the lecture notes, then the lecture comes floating back in front of your mind. But if you give your lecture notes to somebody else and they try and read them, then they're inscrutable, like he says at the end. For those who have not heard the lecture, such notes will be completely useless. If they would try to reconstruct the scientific content of the lecture literally from the notes, they would of necessity make errors. Words, marks that serve those scholars who've heard the lecture as instructive guiding stars to the wisdom they've been taught and learned, stare at the uninitiated as unmeaning sphinxes. What's a sphinx? The Egyptian thing, as you put it, the lion with the head of a person, etc., that gives the riddles, you know, what walks on four legs in the morning, two legs in the afternoon, and three legs in the evening, all that stuff. In other words, if you can crack the code, then you understand the lecture notes. But Rav Hirsch, if you think about it, has done a very, very unusual thing. For Rav Hirsch, what is the main Torah, Bichtav or Baal Peh? Baal Peh. You know, normally speaking, if you were to ask, kind of, if you put them in order, which comes first, which comes second, you would have said Bichtav comes first, and then Baal Peh explains the things that you don't understand in Bichtav. But actually, Rav Hirsch is coming at it from the other angle. He's saying that the real lecture, the real Torah, is Torah Shebaal Peh. Torah Shebichtav is simply a summary to try and help you remember the Torah Shebaal Peh. Now this is an unusual way of thinking about it. And if you remember at the end of the last session, I told you that the way that we were learning Torah Shebaal Peh is that a lot of it develops later. Remember I drew the three columns on the board and I said there's stuff from Sinai, there's stuff that comes later, there's stuff that's developed through drashas, and there is material that's brought in by the rabbis afterwards. Remember all this? Mm-hmm. So you should know that whole approach to Torah Shebaal Peh is itself a very big debate. I will mostly present to you during the course of this course, as it were, a bit tautologist, but during the course of these shiurim, the shita of the Rambam. The shita of the Rambam and the Ramban and others is very much that Torah Shebaal Peh developed. There was Torah Shebaal Peh that came later. It wasn't all given right at the very beginning. That's the shita of the Rambam and the Ramban, and you'll see others. But there is another shita, the Rav Sadia Gaon's shita, the Rav Hirsch takes this shita as well, that actually know everything in Torah Shebaal Peh was given originally at the beginning. All of the principles of halakha were given at the beginning. Things did not develop later. Now, we will, some things obviously developed later, but in the main, the Torah was given at the beginning. Now, that approach is problematic on a number of different levels. The main question is, how do they deal with the issue of machlokas, like I said at the end of the last session? We talked about that, right? How can it be, if everything was given at the beginning, that there is so much machlokas in the system? So all I want to point out to you is that Rav Hirsch is in many ways l'shitato. Do you know what I mean by l'shitato? Faithful to his own approach, which is that really the whole lecture was given at the beginning, and the lecture notes reflect the broad lecture. I'm not sure if you'd have shown this to the Rambam and said, is this how you understand Torah Shebaal Peh? I'm not sure that the Rambam would have agreed exactly with his marshal of the lecture and the lecture notes. Yes?
So does that mean that Rav Hirsch thinks that the nature of machloket was rooted as science?
Yes, to some degree. And to some degree, everybody agrees with that. But he will also downplay how much machloket there is. and say there's less machlokas than you really think. Okay, let's move on. Sources 2 through 5, by the way, I brought you this Rav Hirsch as well in source number 1, because it's very famous and it's something you should know. There are certain things that you should know, famous sections from Rashi, from this, from that. I'd like you to be educated, not just in this subject, but generally, and therefore I brought you the Rav Hirsch because this is something you should really be aware of. Sources 2 through 5 really say the same kind of thing in slightly different kind of ways, which is really that you cannot have a Torah Shebichtav on its own. Source number 2 is the Gemara, which is, I think, very famous, and most of you had trouble with the last section, but I explained it to you, but for those who either knew it before or didn't know it at all, let me go through it now. Have a look at Tanur Rabban. Have a look. Number 2. Ma'aseh b'nochri echa sheva lifnei Shammai. There was this non-Jew that came before Shammai. Now, this page of the Gemara in Shabbos Lamed Aleph has a whole list of stories of non-Jews that came to Shammai and Hillel and asked them to convert under strange or even ridiculous circumstances. You've probably seen some of the other ones. What's one of the other famous ones? A non-Jew comes up to Shammai and says, teach me the whole Torah while I'm standing on one leg. Okay, that's one of them as well. So this is another one that comes on the page, which is, teach me the whole of Torah Shebichtav, but I'm not interested in Torah Shebaal Peh. Ladies, there's lots of talking on this side. I have to separate you. Ma'aseh b'nochri echa sheva lifnei Shammai. Amaloi kama Torah yesh lachem. He says, how many Torahs do you have? Amalei said to him, Shai, two Torahs Shebichtav and Torah Shebaal Peh. Two Torahs. We saw the limit for that in the first sheet. Amalei said to him, okay, Shebichtav ani ma'amincha. I'm with you on Torah Shebichtav. Stuff that God said, I'll go with that. I believe God. I trust God. Shebaal Peh, stuff that the rabbis say, ani ma'amincha. I don't like rabbis. Don't trust them. I just want the stuff that God says. I don't want all the oral stuff. This is a common approach that you hear people say, you know, I don't trust rabbis, I trust God. So, of course, Shammai doesn't have any time for such a person. The guy says to him, Girani al-Manash talamdeni Torah Shebichtav. I want you to convert me on the basis that you only teach me Torah Shebichtav. So what does Shammai do? Garboy! He pushes him out. Bohitzu ben Azif, and he throws him out. Shammai's got no patience for this. That doesn't mean Shammai was a difficult, impatient person. On the contrary, Shammai is the one that says in Pirkei Avos, you should greet every other person with a smile. But Shammai's a Rosh Yeshiva. There are some people that you don't ask nudnik questions to. There are some teachers that you can ask nudnik questions to. And there are some teachers that you know, if you ask them a stupid question, you'll get a very firm response. Okay? So Shammai was the wrong person. He threw him out. Balifnei Hillel. So he comes to Hillel. Hillel was very much more known for being patient, and you know, he says, yeah, right, and he converts him. Yumakama, so what happens on the first day, Amalei says to him, Aleph Bet Gimel Dalet, meaning what? He points to the Aleph base. He says, this is an Aleph, this is a Bet, this is a Gimel, this is a Dalet. Lemachar, on the next day, Epechle, he reverses it. He points to an Aleph and says, this is Dalet. He points to a Bet and says, this is Gimel, etc., etc. So the guy goes nuts. He says, Amalei says to him, Ahadmol, Ahadli Achli. You didn't say it this way yesterday. Why has it changed? Why are you confusing me? So what does Hillel respond to him? Amalai says to him, oh, you want to rely on me? You're prepared to rely on me to tell you what Aleph Bet Gimel Dalet? So you have to rely on me for Torah Shebaal Peh as well. Meaning, if you want to go it alone, in any system of thought, this is a very deep Gemara, a very deep idea. It's saying if you want to go it alone and have no guidance from anybody, you'll never understand anything. Every system comes along with the Torah Shebaal Peh. Every system, every religion, the secular world, the world around us, of science, of law, of medicine, etc. There's always a Torah Shebaal Peh that people tell you how it works. You just have to decide which people you're prepared to rely on. But either way, you're relying on people. Because you can't get away from that. You can't avoid that. Wait, so you don't even know which way to read the Chumash backwards, forwards, unless you know which is Aleph, Bet, Gimel, Dalet.
So, like, if you want to follow me for law, that you should follow me for, like, my...
Meaning you need someone to guide you. If you're prepared to accept me as a guide, then accept me as a guide and realize that Torah Shebaal Peh has to be there. Sources 3 through 5 really flesh this idea out. I'm not going to go through them in detail. The Maharal in number 3. So where did the Maharal live? Yeah, you won't be able to answer that one. When did the Maharal live? He's on my Who's Who. Don't forget to look at my Who's Who every now and then. The Maharal's surely on there. 16th century Prague, okay? He's the Ber Hagola, okay? Is his commentary on the Gadatas. So the Maharal says here in number 3, a person doesn't really know what to do with Torah Shebichtav unless they have a guide. It's very inscrutable, it's very closed. Look at the lines I've just underlined. V'kein b'kol ha-mitzvahs, lo'i ha'ya mitzvah achat, ketano ha-gedoyla. I'm just on the underline bit number three. There's no mitzvah, big or small, shenuchel ha-das perish ha-mitzvah im lo'i ha'ya b'chachmasam ha-gedoyla. Without the chochma of Torah Shebaal Peh, we'd really be very lost. And I'm going to give you a lot of examples of that coming up. People just would turn it all upside down. He said, "V'davar zeh nira v'nivchan l'chol adam maskil." Anyone who's intelligent will realize that they cannot have Torah Shebaal Peh, on its own. Not that we could never reach any kind of truth, but we'd be floundering around. We go from one extreme to the other, we just wouldn't know. That's why I brought you this rather pithy comment in number four from the Sma. The Sma is a commentary on Shulchan Aruch, who rather sort of sardonically writes, Shepiske balabatim, or piske alondim, hein shnei hafachim. Meaning the way that Balabatim see Torah and the way that Loimdim see Torah are light and day, they're day and night. What's a Balabas? So Balabas is a little bit of an insulting word. Not insulting, but it's not a very complimentary word. A Balabas means somebody who is not so learned. Really, someone who doesn't know what they don't know. One of the great goals of I think, becoming more learned in Torah is you can at least reach a stage where you know what you don't know. Or you know how much you don't know. I would respectfully suggest to you at this stage in your Torah career, you don't yet know how much you don't know. Therefore, if you don't know how much you don't know, you think you know a lot. It's only when you realize how much you don't know that you realize how little you know.
A non-learned person reads something and thinks he needs this thing. And
yeah,
then
a little bit of knowledge.
Talmud learns the same thing and just
learns. It's light and day. I tell you something, one of my, this is even worse than a Balabas, one of my rabbis was once approached by one of his congregants. It's a true story. His congregant came up to him after Balabas guy and says to him, "Rabbi," he says, "I don't agree with what you said in your shir." I said, "Oh really? Why is that?" He says, "Yeah," he says, "you may think I'm stupid, Rabbi," he says, "but I've read the Shulchan Baruch from cover to cover," he says. Shulchan Baruch. So the rabbi said, "I want to see this sefer, the Shulchan Baruch. Yeah, what is this sefer?" Yeah, in other words, people who are ignorant look at things in a certain way and think they know everything. A little bit of knowledge is a dangerous thing, yes.
But isn't colloquially a Balabat, somebody who's a Balabat?
Why? Well, how colloquially do you use it?
In my community, when you refer to someone as a Balabat, there's somebody who supports the shul.
Okay, you're right. But the word Balabatim, everywhere you go in the Jewish word, Balabatim generally means people. It's not meant to be used in a derogatory way. No one's trying to judge anybody, but it's like a kind of, like Balabas, he's not really learned properly. He goes to Minyan every day, supports the shul, etc. Nothing wrong with that, it's great. But
it might mean it's kind of used as a compliment.
I agree. It's fine, depends on what you're doing. But at least be aware of what you don't know. That's the main thing. Okay? And that's why the Kuzari says, even the simple stuff when it comes to Torah, even ha-pashut shebatorah hu-satum. Even the stuff that looks simple is not simple. Kal v'chomer, the stuff that doesn't look simple, is certainly not simple. And one of the reasons why is this whole Netziv that I brought you, and I think this is another classic. Who is the Netziv? I brought you a picture of him at the back as well. Who is the Netziv?
This picture is simple, complicated.
Yeah. The Netziv was the Rosh Hashiva of where? The Lashon, excellent. In when? When did he live?
Nineteenth century
Lithuania. Okay, Lita. He was married to the granddaughter of Chaim Volozhiner. Okay, very much part of the Lithuanian tradition. One of the things I want you to get in this course is not just what people say, but who they are and when they live. That's important. And he described in his Hagdama to the Chumash, he wrote a very beautiful Perush on the Chumash, the Netziv, called Haemek Davar. It's one of the last great Chidushim, Chidushei Torah of on Perush al Chumash. We're on source number six. We're about to start that. Meaning, I spoke them very quickly. It doesn't matter. You don't have to do everything in great detail. Meaning, the Netziv wrote a Perush on the Chumash, which is not just interesting and informative, but there's a lot of Chidushim. There are new ideas. He wrote it in the mid 19th century. Most of the new books on Chumash that come out today are really anthologies of what everybody else already said. It's rare that someone comes out with a new book of new ideas of Chidushim in Pshat, and the Netziv was someone who did that. And one of the points that he makes is that Torah calls itself a shira, a poem. Va'asa kitzvu lachem is a shira hazois. You write down this poem, we're told, Moshe's told, at the end of his life. What is it about a poem that makes it different to prose? And the Netziv here in the piece I gave you in number 7 points out two main differences between poetry and prose, which will inform the way that you read the Torah. Because if you pick up the Torah and think that it's a piece of prose, then you will not read it the correct way. Because the Torah works on multiple levels. Yes, on one level it's a law book, on one level it's a story, yes, but on another level it's a poem, even though it's not written like a poem. What are the two main things that the Netziv says there, which are the qualities of poetry, which are different from prose, which are how you have to treat Torah differently? Yes?
One of them is that you can't look at poetry and take it for face value, like just like the Torah. You can't just pick it up and be like, all right, like, this is exactly what it says, so this analogy that it's using, that's exactly what the Torah is.
Right, exactly. A poem, you have to have outside information. Who's here studied English literature? Okay, so when you study English literature, I'm sure you know, there's a whole system. You have to learn how English literature works. When you're learning Shakespeare, you have to learn about Shakespeare. What is he talking about when he says, when he writes a sonnet, and when he writes, shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Thou art more lovely and more temperate. Rough winds doth shake the darling buds of May. What are the darling buds of May, for crying out loud? What's he talking about? You have to learn what he's talking about. You can't just read it, oh, he's talking about a day in the summer somewhere and something about May. You have to bring in the information. He's alluding to this, he's alluding to that, he's alluding to other things that he wrote in other places. You have to read into poetry an awful lot. For every word that's there, there are lines that are not there that you have to fill in. Yes, Ilana?
That's exactly what it is. Like, when you're learning Gemara, they take the sources from the Torah, they take the Mishnah, they take everything and put it together. That's
what I'm saying. That's exactly what I'm saying. No, I'm saying you do. I'm saying you can't read a poem without bringing in outside information. So too, you can't read the Torah without bringing in outside information. Is that what you're saying, or are you saying the opposite?
Yeah, but I heard you can't.
No, I think you misheard me, or I missaid it. Meaning the Torah is like a poem. You can't just read the words of the Chumash and think, oh, that's what it says, I'll take it at face value. Have a look just for a second in little Rashi Aleph. The Bashir, on source number 7, the Bashir, Ein Ha'inyun Mavur Yafa. When it comes to poetry, it doesn't explain things so explicitly. Kamoy Basipur Prozi. This word is prosy. Okay?
Wait,
like it does.
But there was a couple of things.
Yeah, I'm going through it. We're just talking about the first one now. That you have to bring in outside information. But Tzarech La'asos Harot Min Hatzad. You have to bring in stuff from the side. This verse is referring to this story. And this other verse is referring to this. That's not called drush, that's pshat. This is the nature of poetry. Even poetry written by Shakespeare. What does hedyut mean?
Regular.
Even regular poetry, secular poetry. Someone who knows how to read poetry sees new things, it's sweet, it's interesting. They read the poetry, they know what's going on. The dikduka and all its details. More than someone who doesn't have that knowledge. And it says, and this is not called drush, this is called pshat. If I were to ask you, what does the word pshat mean? What is the pshat of a posik? How would you describe the word pshat?
Simple.
Other adjectives?
Basic.
Simple. So I think what the Netziv is telling you is that those words do not describe pshat. Pshat is not basic. Pshat is not simple. Pshat can be highly complex. Pshat is how you read the poem. Therefore, when you're talking about pshat, I suggest that you don't use the word simple, basic. You could use the word, surface level maybe, or superficial even has a superficial has a negative connotation as well. If someone is a superficial person, or something is a superficial thing, it's very hard to translate the word pshat. I don't exactly know which words you should use, but I know you shouldn't use basic, simple. There's nothing basic or simple about it any more, Lahavdil, than reading Shakespeare is basic or simple.
Like the first ring.
It's the first level to get a base. just the word basic. It's so hard to just use it. Like, what's the right word for pshat?
First level,
an entry level understanding. What does literally the word pshat mean? What's the word lifshot? It's spread out. Okay, it's spread out. It's on the surface. Okay, yeah.
I totally missed what you said that Rashi said about this.
I didn't mention Rashi.
You did.
I said the little Rashi A. I just mentioned the Rashi Aleph. Okay, so you didn't miss anything, so you're doing well.
No, so I've got that you need to outside info to understand.
Right, so what's the second now? So I said there were two things about poetry. So that's the first. What's the second? This was his little Rashi bet, the little bet. What was the second thing that he says about poetry which is different from prose, remember? He said when you write poetry, how do you write poetry? You use funny language. You encode things into it. You sometimes see poetry which is written with the name of the author encoded in, especially in Hebrew poetry. Do you ever read any Hebrew poetry?
Yeah.
You know,
Lachadodi.
You know, Lachadodi has written the first lines, the stanzas read what? Shlomo Halevi. Okay? My son once asked me many years ago, now you mentioned Lachadodi, when he was about 9 or 10, he asked me, why is it that it says Shamor v'Zachor v'Dibur Echad? That's the first line of the Chazal, Shamor v'Zachor v'Dibur Echad. That's a misquote. The actual quote from Chazal is Zachor v'Shamor v'Dibur Echad. Says, why has he changed it around and made it Shamor v'Zachor? Which I thought was a nice question from a 9-year-old kid. So I answered him and I said to him, look, he needs to write his name. It's Shlomo. If he was called Zlomo, he would have written Zachor v'Shamor, but he's called Shlomo, so he wrote Shamor v'Zachor. He looked at me as if to say, that's your answer. That's what my rabbinic father has to say on this topic. You don't have anything deeper than that to say. That can't be the answer. He was very, very unhappy with that answer. So I looked into it a little bit more. And Taka, that is one answer that they bring down, but there are other deeper Kabbalistic answers that I didn't understand. So I said, when you're older, you learn Kabbalah, you'll tell me what it means. But for now, so you see that all the time. For example, Dror Yikra. You ever sang Dror Yikra on Shabbos?
Yeah.
Who wrote Dror Yikra? His name is in every single verse. Every single verse has his name. Dalet, Vav, Nun, Shin. Dalet, Vav, Nun, Shin. Dalet, Vav, Nun, Shin. Every verse has his name coded into it. What's his name? Donash. It's not such a popular name now. You can call your kid Donash. You can call him Dunkin' Donash.
I can't remember if someone's name is Duncan.
Yeah? Duncan Donash. Can you imagine? That would be so good. To give a kid two names. Duncan Donash. That's just sublime. Okay. But the point is, we are getting off the point, guys. We digress. His name is in every standard. So he says, so too, the Torah uses words which are not the regular words. You know when you write poetry, sometimes you invert the, you know, you use the, like, the grammar the other way, syntax the other way around to make it rhyme, and you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
So is true of the Torah. So don't read the Torah and say, hey, it's using a funny word, why does it say this, why does it say that? The answer is, you have to read the poetry in the Torah. And therefore, understanding that the whole Torah is a poem is very fundamental. And when you approach it, think of poetry. Some of the people who are best, not everybody, but some of the people who really do well in giving a great sheer in understanding pshat are people who also know how to learn literature. I'm not saying you have to be an expert in learning English literature to give a good pshat sheer, but actually I found that in the past, some people are. Let me quote one example of somebody who is a godel batorah, who is an expert on English literature, and that's from Aaron Lichtenstein. Of Aaron Lichtenstein, who is the Rosh Hashiva of the Gush, has a vast bekias in English literature, as well as an enormous bekias in Torah, and the two go together very well. I'm not saying everyone would be that way, and there's a bit of a hashkafic angle there as well as to whether you go for that or don't go for that, but that's off topic. But understand Torah as a poem. Fine, that's number seven. Yes?
How does that connect to the
Pershabal Peh? So what is this outside information? Where is this coming from? Where is this source of knowledge that I need to be able to interpret the poem? That's Teresh Shabbal Peh. Okay? I asked you at the beginning, how do the Karaites do it? Who are the Karaites? Right. Well, in theory, that's what people say, but that's not actually true. Because nobody can only believe in Torah Shebichtav, because when you open the book, you don't know what's going on. They had issues with the rabbis, that's the point. They have their own form of Torah Shebal Peh. They have their own system of Torah analysis. The Karaites were a massive group of people throughout the Middle Ages, starting from around the 9th century through to the 13th, 14th century. Some of the major works of rabbinic literature are works of polemic against the Karaites. The Kuzari is aimed against the Karaites. Many of the things the Rambam had to deal with against the Karaites. When the Rambam took over as the rabbi of Cairo, 2/3 of his community were Karaites. Okay? The Karaites were people who followed a system where they didn't accept the rabbinic version of Torah Shebal Peh. But they had to invent their own Torah Shebal Peh, because there is no way that you can understand Torah without it. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. What is Yom Teruah? Yom Teruah. What does that mean? It's a day of Teruah. What does Teruah mean? So does it mean blowing? Does it mean screaming? Does it mean praying? Does it mean crying? How do you understand that? There are still Karaites today. I know people. I don't actually know anyone directly, but I know people who've known Karaites, and there are very few today. There are some living in Israel, there are some living in Russia, there are some actually living in LA, in California. I don't know if it's LA, but they're certainly California. Yeah, they have to develop their own thing. They decided for, and you can work out whether it was the politics that led them to break off, or whether it was the theology, a little bit like the Tzedukim. Who were the Tzedukim? The Tzedukim were a long time before the Karaites. The Tzedukim were already Beit Sheni, and the two groups obviously never met, but they both have in common that they had issues with the rabbinic establishment. Again, whether they were political issues which led to theological issues, or whether they were originally, you know, philosophical, theological issues, that's a good question, you can study it. But the Tzedukim also had this issue. With the Tzedukim there was a lot of politics, because there was a lot of Second Temple politics going on at the time, but they also had this issue that they didn't want the rabbinic understanding of Torah, but they also have to have their own understanding. You can't just read it at face value. Yes?
The Karaites are the Karaim, right?
Karaim, yes. Why are they called Karaim? No, that's with an ayin.
Mikra.
Yeah, from Mikra. Kra'im. Okay? From Kra, meaning their focus is on Mikra. There is, by the way, another group of people who you shouldn't get confused with them, who are the Shomronim. Who are the Shomronim?
Oh, they're the ones that they came from the lion that they had to convert.
So who are they today? I said that there are Karaites around, you can find them, they have their own website and things, but who are the Shomronim? The Samaritans. And where will you find the Samaritans? I don't mean like you call them up and you...
Christianity?
No, they're not Christians.
They have their own, like, Beit HaMikdash where they live.
They don't have a Beit HaMikdash, but they have like a holy mountain. Where do the Samaritans live?
Who are the Samaritans?
Yeah, the Shomronim. Okay?
They live in the Shomron.
They live in Samaria, okay, which is the Shomron. And they're even smaller than the Karaites. And they used to be massive as well. In the Second Temple time, the Shomronim were an enormous group, and there was massive battles between the Shomronim. So what did they also have, in theory, no Torah Shebal Peh, only Torah Shebichtav. I went to visit the Shomronim. I have some good pictures, actually. Maybe I'll bring them in one day. Actually, I have them on one of the sheets later on. I went to visit the Shomronim on Sukkot a few years ago, and I asked them all these questions about their, you know, what the halacha that they keep and all that. And they say they have no Torah Shebal Peh, but they do. I asked the guy, do they keep meat and milk separately in the house? And he said, of course. And I said, why? So he didn't know. So he said, I have to ask the Kohen Gadol. So they have a Kohen Gadol. So he says everything he didn't know, he said he had to ask the Kohen Gadol. So in the end, I said I should really be sitting here with the Kohen Gadol. Never mind with you. I mean, whatever. But it's clear that they doesn't say anywhere in the pasukim, in the cry, in the mikra, that to separate meat and milk. Certainly not pots in the house.
Well, it's like yes, but ask the Kohen Gadol, doesn't that
show? Okay, so whatever. The Shomron is a whole other story, but that's for a later shiur. Yes.
Wait, so they believe that.
No, they don't believe Mashiach is here. They believe...
Why do they have a Kohen Gadol and a Beit HaMikdash and a whole...
Because they believe the whole thing should be in Hargrizim. We'll talk about the Shomronim later on.
Hargrizim.
Hargrizim, up in the north near Shechem. Maybe we should do a school trip up there. Maybe not, actually. But
even in the Mikra, even in the Torah itself, it's...
We'll get to the Shomronim when we get to the Shomronim. It's around Shir 27. We'll get to the Shomronim. It'll make sense then. But for now, just understand that there have always been groups that have said, we prefer our own interpretation of Torah Shebichtav. But they always have to have one. You can't have Torah Shebichtav on its own. Yes?
Why
It's actually a phenomenal book that was on the bestseller list a couple of years ago called The Year of Living Biblically.
Yes.
Where this guy kind of lived according to the Torah. And
yeah, I don't know if I agree it was a phenomenal book.
I mean, I thought it was hilarious.
It was hilarious, but the whole thing was, it was a bit ignorant, you know? The guy's taking Torah Bichtav, reading the verses and saying, you know, let's stone someone, so he has lots of little stones and he stones people. And it's like a joke. The book is like a joke. I mean, it was written as...
Is it making fun of Torah?
Yeah, it is, really. It was... Okay, I didn't read the whole book,
yeah,
in fairness. But what he's not doing, in fairness, is he's not using any Torah Baal Peh. And therefore, he can say, look at this posik, isn't this weird? And the answer is, yes, it is to you, because you're not using any Torah Baal Peh, which leads me into what I'm talking about now, Torah Baal Peh. Do you have a question?
Yeah.
Go on, Ilana.
Okay. So you know how, like, if you want to define a word, and you use the same word to define that word,
yes.
Yes. So, like, the sources...
You like a circular argument.
What?
Like a circular argument, you're using something to define the same thing. What are you trying to say?
Like, let's say I want to define the word water bottle.
Yes.
So like, it's a bottle that holds water.
Okay, so then that you didn't get anywhere. Exactly. You need to still define the word bottle and define the word water.
Right. So the sources that we're using to define what Torah Shabbat and what Torah is, they come from the Torah and the Torah Shabbat.
Okay.
So how do we know that?
Oh, good. How do we know? All I'm showing to you, I'm not proving to you anything. I mean, it's not a proof, quotes and quotes, based course. I'm not trying to prove to you that the Torah Shabbat is true. I'm trying to show to you that there has to be a Torah Shabbat. At the end of the day, you have to decide, we have to decide, everyone has to decide which group of people they feel have the most... they have the most confidence in, they have the most connection to, are the people that are most worth putting their trust in terms of deciding what the Torah Shabbat Peh should be. All I'm doing for the moment is trying to explain that there has to be a Torah Shabbat Peh, according to everybody.
But
not that this one is the correct one.
Like, according to the Torah Shabbat Peh.
No, but okay, so fine. So if you didn't learn this Torah Shabbat Peh, how would you understand Torah Shabbat Peh?
I don't know, the way that they're carried.
But they don't, but they have their own Torah Shabbat Peh. What I'm saying is there has to be an oral explanation.
You can do it like the Christians do in creating new Bibles.
Look, I brought you source number 8 where he says that even the verse Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, there's a philosophical point being made by the Sefer Ikrim. He's making the point that the Torah cannot be perfect without having a way to understand it. And if you just look at the verses on their own, they can be read in a million different ways. In number 8, the Ikrim, the Sefer Ikrim, Yosef Albo. He says even something as apparently clear as Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, which is that God is one. I mean, how can you get that wrong? He says the Christians use this as a proof that God is three. So, in other words, you need some way to guide you through this book. Now, you're telling me that how do I know this way is the right way or that way is the right way? Okay, that's a good question.
You're just saying that there needs to be something.
I'm just saying for now that unless you accept the need for a way, then you're mamash stuck. You have a completely useless book, because it doesn't make any sense. And I've brought you a whole bunch of examples of why Torah Shabbat Peh is fundamental. Again, I'm not going to convince you that this Torah Shabbat Peh is better than that Torah Shabbat Peh. Just that there needs to be a Torah Shabbat Peh. Look at the examples, and some of them are very well known. Look at 9 and 10. What does it say? You cannot eat this thing called Chet Lamed Vav. No. I just mentioned it briefly, but you don't have to know everything. You cannot use this thing called Chet, eat this thing called Chet Lamed Vav. What is that?
Chelev.
How do you know it's Chelev?
Because context.
No, it's not because of context, Hannah. It would read perfectly well if you said, Kol Chalav Shor, the Keves, the Ez, Lotso Chelu, do not drink the milk of any kosher animal. But how do you know? That's what it says.
Because you're allowed to drink milk of a kosher.
How do you know?
Ball pen. You wouldn't know.
You wouldn't know. Unless you turn around and say Shore is male and therefore it can't be, it can't be, it can't be, it can't be.
Is Shore always male?
Shore, yeah, Shore. Kesev is certainly male. It would be Kisva.
And
Ayu? Ayu, I'm not sure. What's the floor? The A is a goat. What would be the? I'm not sure. That's an interesting point. I only just thought of that now. So you're saying that maybe from its context you could imply that.
No, I'm saying it's from the portion, but they're all male, so it doesn't make sense that it would be milk anyway.
Okay, maybe.
It only makes like.
But number 10, you really couldn't tell. Loit vashel gedi be imoy. That could be the chelev imoy, because the mother has fat. It could be a prohibition on cooking meat, in fact.
But that would also be already decided from the first cousin. Is one for the other?
Well, one is after the other. The ein mugdam amukam b'tayra. Yeah, but anyway, ein mugdam amukam b'tayra. What are you trying to say? I'm ignoring you. I'm sorry.
No, 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 no.
Okay, but how do you know it's not chaylevi moi?
How do you know?
That's the question.
Exactly. How do you know? Maybe there's no prohibition of meat and milk in the Torah. There's no vowels in the Torah. You only know the vowels from Torah Shebal Peh. The vowels don't exist in Torah Shebal Peh. Therefore, the pronunciation of, when you read an English translation of the Bible, when you read the King James Bible, the King James English translation assumes the Torah Shebal Peh. Otherwise, he wouldn't know how to translate the words. Yes.
But it doesn't actually make sense, because if you're going by the first one, Diagra, Kol, Chalav, Chalav, Shor, blah, 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 they're all male, there's no milk, so let's just say that means Chalav. But then why would...
Unless you say it means these species, but anyway, so, okay, fine.
Then let's see, why would it specifically mention that you can't cook the already decidedly non-kosher fat, specifically with the mother and whatever? When we already decided it's not kosher, so you can't cook it with anything.
So you're saying if the first one has to be chaylev, then the second one has to be chalav, because it has to be something else. It has to be something else. I hear. I was just going to say that. But isn't that a kind of kosher bal peh as well?
But you're your own kosher bal peh.
Right, I understand. There has to be some system of analysis in order to make it work. Even just to the punctuation, leaving aside the vowels. You know, I put you on the top of page 3, punctuation is very critical. In English and in Hebrew. You know the famous quote, a panda eats, shoots, and leaves.
Women without her man is it women without her man?
Right.
Or is it women without her man?
Right. Women without her man is useless. Exactly. So look in the passage number 11.
I like Let's Eat Grandma.
Right.
Oh, that's so good.
Slow children crossing. Look at number 11. Ladies, here's an example which is more Torah oriented. Loisik noivu, do not steal. The loisachachshu v'lo tshakru ish v'amitoi, and don't lie and don't deny claims. Each one to his fellow amits. What's an amit? Not a nation. That's an am.
Friend.
Usually ish v'amitoi means Jew to Jew. Okay, Jew to Jew. What's the matter? You look as though you're about to burst.
Yeah, I'm upset with
this. Oh, okay. Okay. Fine. Let's leave aside that for 1 second. The Torah seems to be saying that these things are prohibited between Jews and Jews. And yet the halacha is very clear. The loisig noivu, stealing, is not just prohibited between Jews and Jews. You're absolutely not allowed to steal from anybody, whether they're Jewish or whether they're non-Jewish. So how do you fit that into the pasuk? How can you say, it says, ish v'amitoi at the end, it qualifies it between Jew and Jew. So it comes along the Ritva and says, no, you nudnik, you didn't read the word properly. It's not loisig noivu and then you read it up. It's loisig noivu with a little esnachta on the bottom. What's an esnachta? In other words, there's a pause. Loisig noivu, pause. Means you put a period there. And then you say, v'loi techachashu v'loi techachu ishva amitai. So ishva amitai is only qualifying the last two verbs, not the first one. How would you know that? You'd only know that if you sing it right. That's why the people who sing the laning have to sing it right. If you sing the wrong notes, you're mixing up all the punctuation. You're reading out, let's eat grandma. Or the Jewish equivalent, or the Torah equivalent of that. And you're messing up the whole thing. If you read this, lo signoivu, lo sechachashu, then you... The Ritva, number 12. The Ritva points out that the etnachta makes the entire difference to the pasuk. It changes the nature of the halacha. So the halacha is based not just in the letters, but in the vowel, in the punctuation. Where is the punctuation? Torah Shebal Peh. Without Torah Shebal Peh, you don't know any of the notes. They were only kept Shebal Peh until eventually they were written down in notation form. Quite late, in the 8th, 9th century. That's the horseshoe, yes.
So if this is so important,
yes.
Why don't we teach everybody the Tame and the Kra, even if we're not going to lean?
Should. In fact, the halacha is when you say the Shema, you meant to say it with the Tamei HaMikra.
In Israel, I think they do. My cousin, she's 8, she learned it in my first grade.
Okay.
They taught it.
100%. I know communities in England where the whole community, when they get to the Shema, they all lane it in the community together. Let me ask you a question. Okay, one second. Before you even go on, let me do an experiment. Okay. Ladies, can someone read me this verse? Yes. Okay, wrong. Okay, anyone else? Yes. Okay, so what did you do different? So how do you say this word? How do you say this word? V'ahavta. It's not V'ahavta. The most natural thing to pronounce it is V'ahavta. V'ahavta.
You love.
Who says V'ahavta? Everyone says V'ahavta es Hashem Elokecha. It's the wrong word. It's the wrong word. It means and you love. It's V'ahavta. V'ahavta. Yeah. So if you pronounce this word wrong, you never said the Shema.
Is that in Moshe? Moshe. It's really good.
So, yes, Nadiva, Nadiva. Ladies, why is everybody so noisy today? Okay, it's about 3 seconds all singing together. Okay, so guys, go away and learn the trot. Go away and learn the notes. Just 1 second, I need to go on, I only have 10 minutes. I used to be a lawyer. When you're a lawyer, one of the first things you learn is you have to have definitions. You cannot write a legal document without definitions. If you're going to use words, you have to know what they mean. The buyer, the seller, you have to know what day means, night means. You have to define these things. You can't just rely on people to make it up. So too in the Torah, it says things like, don't do any melacha. And if you do, we'll stone you. So how do you know? How do you know what you're not allowed to do? I suppose you could find out the hard way. Okay? Like, it says in the book on Yom Kippur, it says, V'inisem es nashe seichem. What does that mean? Afflict yourselves. So what does that mean? It doesn't say don't eat. It doesn't say don't drink. It says afflict yourselves. What does that mean? Maybe you have to bang your head against the wall every 5 minutes. Maybe you have to roll around in the snow and whip yourself. You like that idea, right? I can look at Adele. She's going, yay. There are so many things in the Torah that make no sense unless you define them. The book itself is begging for another system. And in fact, there are specific examples. And I brought you a few. For example, when it comes to Shechita. When it says about Shechita, the text itself cross-refers. Look at number 13. It says, when you come to shecht animals, v'zavachta, look at the words I've underlined, v'zavachta mibikarcha, you will shecht your animals, u'mitzoincha, and your sheep, asher nasan lecha Hashem, which God has given you, Hashem lecha, ka'asher tzivisicha, you will shecht them the way that I commanded you to shecht them.
Well,
now, it doesn't say anywhere in the Torah how to shecht them. So why is there a reference in the Torah, Ka'asher Tzivisicha, I've told you somewhere. So if you look at Rashi, number 14, Lamadnu Sheyesh Tzivui B'Tzvicha, this teaches that there is elsewhere a command how to shecht, Heich Yishchot, Vehem Halochah Hilcha Shechita Shenemru L'Moshe B'Sinai. These are the halachas of Shechita that we learned at Sinai, how to shecht animals. And the Rambam says the same idea, that when it says Ka'asher Tzivisicha, it's talking about cross-referencing to a group of laws that exist elsewhere. There are some things which we have no idea what they are. Tefillin. It doesn't say in the Torah anywhere the word tefillin. And even if it did, what the heck does tefillin mean?
Oh, it says
totafot. It says totafot. And what on earth does that mean? Totafot. Phylacteries.
Yeah, that.
Well, I mean, that's not very helpful. Phylacteries. So how would you know that tefillin are black, square, leather? How do you know they're not pink, round, fluffy? That's very conventional of you, Hannah. Let me ask you a more fundamental question. I wrote on the sheet here. Ladies, I wrote on the sheet here. How do you know where to do a Brit Milah?
Good question.
First round pair.
It doesn't say. It doesn't say. It just says you have to cut off some of the skin. That's the orla. So he talks elsewhere about the orla of your ears. He talks about metaphorically of the cutting away the orla of our ears, the orla of our hearts. Yeah. Over the page. In C4. So you and I know where they perform a Bris Milah. I'm not going to spell it out for you. But that's only Teresh Baal Peh. And Shi'urim, it says, eat this. How much I need to eat? Is it a kazayas? Is it a kabetza? It says eat matzah. What does it mean to eat? Is eating, define eating. You're going to sit around and say, oh, come on, everyone else. But is it chewing or swallowing? What happens if I'm sick afterwards? Is that still considered to have eaten it? Or do I have to eat another one?
You have to
digest it, etc. Yeah, how full is full? Do you have to be bursting? Is it just, you know, all of these things, you quickly come grind to a halt and you realize you don't have any clue. Ladies, I'm going to ask you not to talk for the next 5 minutes. Which birds are kosher? It doesn't give you a list. It's only a masorah as to which birds are kosher. How do you get married? It says how you get divorced, but it doesn't say how you get married. It assumes that you know how to get married. Look at number 17, 1 second, Abby. Look at number 17 for a second. This is talking about an Amma Ibriya. Who's an Amma Ibriya? A girl from a poor family, where her family puts her into, she's not a slave, her family puts her into another family to work with a view that she will live with them, she will have money from them because they can't afford to bring her up, and that she'll get married to someone from the family. She'll get married to one of the sons from the family when they get older. So it says in 17, Im Livno Ye Adena, if indeed they decide she's going to get married to the son, Kemishbat Habanot Ya'asela, they have to make sure that she gets the Mishbat Habanot. Even though she's the maid, you're only marrying the maid, you might have thought, oh, it doesn't matter for the maid. The answer is no. She must get Mishpat Habanot, the laws of all good Jewish women. What are those laws? The Pasuk just assumes you know. Mishpat Habanot. Where is that referred to? Again, somewhere else. So you quickly come across the clear understanding that Torah Shebaal Peh is a critical part of Torah Shebichtav. Leaving aside the fact that there are clear, quote-unquote, inconsistencies, you know, how many days do you count the Omer? Well, in one place it says 49, in one place it says 50. How many days of Pesach? In one place it says 60, in one place it says 7. How many Levim are there? It gives the numbers for the Levim. It adds them up. The number comes to 22,300, and it says there are 22,000. Like, why? Can't you just add up four numbers? It's in the same pasuk. You know, how can you get mixed up there? Very quickly you come to an understanding that Torah Shebaal Peh is critical for the system. In the last 3 minutes, the Beis Halevi, and let me just mention the idea of the Beis Halevi, because some of you started reading it, but most of you didn't. The Beis Halevi says a beautiful idea, and let me say it out. It's a nice vort for the Shabbos table, but it's a much deeper idea than that as well. The Beis Halevi says the following, and I'm summarizing here sources 20 through 26 in 3 minutes, which is ambitious, but it's the best we can do. Ladies, there's too many people in the class for me to talk over you. The Beit Halevi was Rav Yosef Ben Soloveitchik, the great grandfather of the Rav Soloveitchik that you know from America. His great grandfather, who had the same name, he was named for him, was also Rav Yosef Ben Soloveitchik. He was also a Rosh Hashiva in Volozhin, around the time of the Netziv and before the Netziv. So he has a beautiful idea, and he says the following, that when Moshe Rabbeinu received the first Luchos, so the first Luchos, he says, had everything written on Torah Shebaal Peh and Torah Shebichtav. In fact, he makes an interesting textual point, and he says that whenever it says that the Ten Commandments were written on the Luchos, it only ever says that about the second Luchos. And it's amazing, you'd never even think about it unless you see his proofs. He says the first Luchos he never mentions in connection with the Ten Commandments. He says that's because everything was written b'derech neis on the first Luchos. So what happens? Originally, Torah Shebaal Peh and Torah Shebichtav are meant to be all written down together and given to Klal Yisrael. But what do? They do the Chet HaEgel. The Chet HaEgel means the following, that they're going to have to go into Golas. And since they're going to have to go into Golas, the Torah Shebaal Peh has to be Baal Peh. because that's the only thing that's going to distinguish them now from the non-Jews around them. In other words, the non-Jews will take the Torah and claim it's theirs. We are the true Israel, which is indeed what the Christians did, the Muslims did. They said the Bible is our Bible, as it were. So Torah Shebaal Peh has to now be specific to the Jews, and therefore that what's written on the Luchos can no longer be written on the Luchos. So what flies away into the air, you know the Medrash, which talks about the letters flying away? So is the Torah Shebaal Peh returning, as it were, this all midrashic, and now Moshe is left holding only Shei Torah Shebichtav, which is no longer self-sustaining. It now needs Torah Shebaal Peh, so that has to be destroyed. So he destroys the first Luchos, because what they have on them is now no longer tenable. They have a Torah that no longer works. They have the Torah Shebichtav without the Torah Shebaal Peh, and therefore he throws them to the floor. The second Luchos now have a new system completely, where Torah Shebaal Peh and Torah Shebichtav are two different systems, and he now has the Ten Commandments, and Torah Shebaal Peh is a separate system, and he builds this through so beautifully. He works in all the Midrashim, he works in all the Psukim, and he explains how the whole Luchos system and Torah Shebaal Peh and Torah Shebichtav go together. So he says originally it was meant to be written down, and that's why Moshe, when Moshe asks on the second Luchos, shall I write everything down again? The answer this time is no. This time there has to be Bichtav, this time there has to be Baal Peh. And this is a good segue, this is a good introduction to the next shiur. With the next shiur on Thursday, Be'ezrat Hashem, is I want to show you why it's so important that Baal Peh has to be Baal Peh. Why can't it be written down? Of course, eventually it was. We'll have to work out how that happened. But why, in principle, can Torah Shebaal Peh not be in writing? And that's what I want to cover Be'ezrat Hashem on Thursday. Okay, we'll leave it there for now.